everyone. Thanks so much for coming. I'm really excited to host this panel of wonderful writers. I'm going to introduce them in order of those who are closest to me. First up, we have Chuck Klosterman, who's written a number of books about American popular culture. Most recently, he has turned his attentions to fiction. He wrote Downtown Owl, and this year he has just come out with The Visible Man. And then we have Gregory Maguire. He has written many fairy tales, for revisionist fairy tales for adults and children, among them Wicked, which is, of course, a ginormous musical. And he has concluded that series with a book that's coming out in a couple weeks called Out of Oz. And then we have Kate Beaton, who is included in this year's Best American Comics with her comics about The Great Gatsby. She is responsible for the webcomic Hark a Vagrant, and she has recently released a book of that same name. And then finally, we have Karen Russell. She was chosen by the New Yorker editors for their 20 Under 40 list, and she is the author of a book of short stories, St. Lucie's Home for Girls Raised by Wolves, and the novel Swamplandia. So thank you.
Hello, thanks for coming. Huge crowd here. I love when there are balconies. Whenever you read a balcony event, it kind of feels like it might be a doomed Doors concert, and someone might fall off the top. I'm a little nervous, of course, because I was told just before I came out here that some people are here for free, and some people paid $10. For the people who are, you know, got in for free, you're like, oh, up for anything, very freewheeling, you know? But I'm always nervous about the people who paid money, because I feel that I have to provide $10 of entertainment. So I have to be as interesting as, like, a night of Wi-Fi in your hotel room. But then I realized there are four speakers, so it's really just 250, so that's like a lot of candy. So I will try to be as interesting as a lot of candy. This is the book I just wrote. It's called The Visible Man. And I'm not going to read too long because, as I'm sure everyone knows but hates kind of to admit in public, whenever you go to a book reading, the dullest part is always the reading. You know, watching someone read a book in public is just not interesting. I mean, unless you're a child. But even then, it's not that great. Also, because this is a novel, if you just read one section, it doesn't really make a lot of sense. And in fact, if someone can read a page or two of your book and understand what it's about, it's like a bad book. even if it's like Go Dog Go, if you only read two pages, you're like, well, the dogs are in motion. I see that. But it's like... Regardless, okay, what this book is about, essentially, is primarily about two characters. One is a scientist who's extremely narcissistic and unlikable. He has the ability to become invisible. The reason I did this, or the reason I made him this way, had a little bit to do with the original, The Invisible Man, by H.G. Wells, but also just sort of, I came to the conclusion that if somebody had both the mental ability to become invisible and sort of the kind of lack of morality to use it in order to watch people when they weren't being observed, that is the kind of character he would have to be. It would have to be sort of this really self-absorbed narcissist. In order for him to communicate, though, and for there to be a story, he talks to this therapist. And the therapist's name is Victoria Vick. She lives in Austin, Texas. And but then I thought to myself, you know, what kind of therapist would put up with this terrible, unlikable person who just sort of pedantically lectures at her? Well, it would have to be somebody who's kind of a pushover, maybe somebody whose whole life they've been used to being sort of dominated by men to a degree and have kind of accepted this as normalcy. So what we basically have is we have a very unlikable character talking to a character no one could possibly relate to or want to relate to. So I guess the far-out aspect of this panel or this book is that I'm trying to sell a book where no one will like anyone in it. But it just kind of worked out that way. What can I do? The section that I'm going to read from, which is just sort of going to be like maybe 2 minutes, is a period where the invisible man who is visible, there's an explanation of that, it's very long, but the invisible visible man has had a session of therapy with Victoria. And he had just been spying on this elderly half-Mexican man who had schizophrenia, and the visible man somehow relates to the schizophrenic, and they've talked about why he would relate to a man with schizophrenia. And then the session ends, and the therapist is kind of mulling this over. And then she decides to go get a coffee at a coffee house nearby. So she walks to the coffee house, and she gets her caramel macchiato, and she comes out, and there is the guy. Because obviously when he comes to therapy, he doesn't, you know, invisible up all the time. He's just his normal self. She sees the guy, doesn't know if she should talk to him or not, because it's sort of weird to fraternize with your clientele outside of work. But she's like, well, this guy's pretty crazy. He's this insane scientist. Nothing has been normal. I'm going to sit and chat with this guy. So they sit in a bench in front of this coffee house, and they have a little conversation, and three things are discussed. This is one of the things. The first thing they talk about was she wants to know, like, how it feels to be invisible. And he gives a very strict definition of how it tangibly, technically feels. And it has to do with, he's wearing this suit that involves like a cloaking cream. I don't know how far I should get into this, but this guy is, it's basically a type of high-level camouflage that allows him to watch people in order, because in his mind, the only way to really understand someone is to see them when they're not aware that they're being observed. If you interview people, that process changes the encounter. If you survey people, people give the answers they think that they want to hear. So he decides the only way to understand human nature, his scientific kind of motive, is to watch these people when they can't be seen. So he does this invisibility stuff. She asks him how this feels. He kind of explains how it feels and how it looks. And then she says, "That's bizarre," I responded, because he's just said something bizarre. "But it wasn't what I wanted to know. That really wasn't the question I'd asked. I wanted to know how being invisible felt. I wanted to know if being invisible was something he liked or just something he did." "You're obsessed with feelings," he said. "Which is natural, considering your occupation. You traffic in feelings. And I'm not one of those retrograde automatons who insist they're immune to emotion until they end up having a stroke. I don't have contempt for emotion. But you misread things. People don't think about themselves. People think about themselves constantly, but not in the way you imagine. The only time people are conscious of how they feel is when something hurts them. Most of the time, we train ourselves to ignore the entire sensation. I certainly don't believe it's possible to be successful at anything complicated if you let feelings dictate how you live. It always seems like you're trying to direct me towards some sort of grand realization. I always get the impression that you want me to say something incisive, like, it makes me feel powerful, or it makes me feel alone, or it makes me feel special. And all of those descriptions are true some of the time, but none are true all of the time. Everything eventually becomes normal. The first time I realized I could enter someone's home, there was this predictable rush of power. There was an immediate recognition that I could do anything I wanted. I could kill a man and never be captured. I could rape a woman, and she'd assume it was just a horrific nightmare. You think about things like that when you're different than the rest of society. You think about these things all the time. But the fact of the matter is that I'm not a rapist. And the fact that I suddenly had the means to become a world-class rapist wasn't going to change that. We always end up being ourselves somehow. I was who I was long before I consciously became the person I am. Being unseen makes me feel different than other people, but I've always felt different than other people. Invisibility isn't the issue. The difference is that I've always possessed the single-minded dedication to make an impossible scenario plausible. I have the power to invent my own life. Even if I'd spent the past 20 years sitting on a beach and drinking myself stupid, I would still feel powerful and alone and special. Those are simply the intermittent qualities of who I always am, regardless of how I feel about it. So basically, that's a good passage if you really want to understand why this person is awful. But the reason I read this is because, even though it's not, I guess, necessarily far out, I think when we talk about the idea of fiction that goes outside the real sort of easy, understandable day-to-day life, where, you know, like a Jonathan Franzen novel or whatever, where it's a really great depiction of sort of what your life could be like, or maybe what your interior like, when you get something that's farther out, I guess this would be terrestrial science fiction because it's not in space, I think what happens is you're dealing with people who are very confused, and their confusion within the realm of standard reality is kind of the weirdness. And how are people confused? Well, I feel that in life there tends to be two things that make someone generally confused. They are either extremely confident about what is unknowable, or they overthink and are very perplexed by the straightforward. They overthink like what's obviously happening and try to create different scenarios around it. And that's principally the thing in this book that this main character struggles with. He has a great deal of confidence about understanding things no one can understand, and yet very simplistic, straightforward relationships always totally baffle him, and he tries to figure out different ways to explain why things are happening. So that's sort of what this book is like, except probably slightly dumber and with more Beatles references. So thank you.
Well, that was great, and I wish I could have paid more attention, but I kept trying to think, if I'm only worth $2.50 in a hotel room, what am I? And then I thought, I know, I'm the bottle of Perrier in the fridge that somebody opened before and let all the gas out of. And so, you know, you still have to pay for it if you take it out of the fridge. Oh, well, here you are, here we are, and here I am, about to be out of Oz. Out of Oz is the fourth and final book in my Wicked sequence called The Wicked Years, which began with the novel Wicked. And it feels to me like a little bit of a bait and switch to talk too much about this book since, you know, sorry, but it's not out for 2 weeks. So I don't want to kind of get you all lathered up and have no place to go. So I'm just going to read, like a page and a half from the beginning and then a couple of paragraphs at the end of the prologue. But then I'll talk a little bit about the questions that are most often asked me, which is, how did a musical come into your life and how did it affect your writing? Because you kept writing about these characters long after Broadway got hold of them. But here is Out of Oz. It would take Dorothy Gale and her relatives 3 days to reach the mountains by train from Kansas, the conductor told them. No matter what the school teachers had said about Galileo, Copernicus, and those other spoil sports, any cockamamie theory that the world was round remained refuted by the geometrical instrument of a rattling train applied to the spare facts of a prairie. Dorothy watched eagles and hawks careering too high to cast shadows. She watched the returning larks and bluebirds, and she wondered what they knew about the shape of the world and if they would ever tell her. Then the Rockies began to ice up along the spring horizon beyond the shoot-'em-up town of Denver. Uncle Henry had never seen such a sight. He declared himself bewildered at their height. They surely do remind me of the great Kells of Oz, agreed Dorothy, though the Kells looked less bossy somehow. She tried to ignore the glance Uncle Henry shared with Aunt Em. Some of the passes being snowed over, even in April, early April, the train made slower progress than the timetable had promised. Aunt Em fretted that their hotel room would be given away. Uncle Henry replied with an attempt at savoir faire. I'll wire ahead at the next opportunity, Em. Hush yourself. Enjoy the nation. What a charade that they were accustomed to taking fancified holidays. They had little extra money for emergencies, Dorothy knew. They were spending their savings on her behalf. The train chuffed along valleys noisy with rushing waters, inched across trestles as if testing them for purchase. It lollygagged up slopes. One cloudy afternoon, it maneuvered through so many switchbacks that the travelers lost all notion of east and west. In her seat, Dorothy hummed a little. Oh, once she thought she saw a castle on a ridge, but that was only a tricky rock formation. But I never before saw a rock that looked like a castle, said Aunt Em brightly. You never saw a castle, thought Dorothy, and tried not to be disappointed. They worried their way through Nevada and its brownish springtime, and at last came down into California, through a napland of orchards and vineyards. When the train paused outside Sacramento to take on tinder, Dorothy saw a white peacock strutting along next to the tracks like a general surveying his troops. It paused at her window and fanned out its impossible stitchery. She could have sworn it was a white peacock and that it would speak. But Toto began to yap out the open window, and the bird kept its own counsel. Finally, the train shrugged and chuffed into San Francisco, a city so big and filthy and confounding that Uncle Henry dared to murmur, "This beats your old Emerald City, I'll warrant." "Henry," said his wife, "pursed lips are kind lips." They found their hotel. The clerk was nice enough, a clean young man whose lips weren't so much pursed as rubied. He forgave their delay, but could no longer promise to supply them with a room only one flight up, as they'd been promised. Aunt Em refused to try Mr. Otis's hydraulic elevator, so they had to climb five flights. They carried their own bags to avoid having to tip. Now, they're there in San Francisco. Uncle Henry and Aunt Em are spending their savings to try to show Dorothy that the country she has in her mind is sick. It's a sickness. It didn't happen. She's never going to get married if she can't shake it. Aunt Em doesn't actually take to travel, so she stays in her hotel. And one night, Uncle Henry and Dorothy go out to a Chinese restaurant there first. They are given fortune cookies before they leave. By the red light of the Chinese lantern leering over their table, Uncle Henry worked to decipher his secret message. His book learning had been brief. "Mid pleasure and palaces, though we may roam, be it ever so humble, there's no place like home," he read. "John Howard Payne." "Payne is right," said Dorothy, meaning no disrespect, Uncle Henry. "He has a point, though, Dorothy. Be it ever so humble, and we got the humble part covered good enough. There's no place like home. Now you read yours." "My mind to me a kingdom is. Such present joys therein I find that it excels all other bliss that earth affords or grows by kind." Sir Edward Dyer. "Dyer is right," said Uncle Henry. Well, the next night, Dorothy can't sleep. In the early morning, Toto has to do his business. She takes him out of the hotel. And on the way back in, with Uncle Henry and Aunt Em asleep, she goes into the lobby. It's about 5 in the morning. The elevator man was asleep in a lounge chair, his head to one side and his little lap askew. In that funny high-waisted jacket, he looked like a flying monkey she had once known. How were they ever affording this, poor dear Henry and Em, late of the Kansas Prairie, so frightened of her, so eager for an acceptable future, she would make it worth their while. She stepped into the elevator and pulled the door shut. The door was fretted like sets of linked scissors, like the threads of an old apron if you scrub it too hard with lye. She gripped the brass handle and revolved it a full half turn, and the floor began to lift. She goes to the 9th floor to see if in the dawn light she can see the ocean. They haven't been able to spy it yet. She does get a little glimpse, but Toto gets very anxious being that high. And she says, "Oh, Toto, stop your internal fussing. The wind isn't going to take you. Once in your life was enough." She picked up the dog and went back into the building. The elevator was where she had left it, quivering at this height. She would ride it down to the 5th floor and go in and rest next to her aunt and uncle. She had spied something of the ocean, some little hem of it. The globe was round. She could see that there was another world beyond this one. That would have to do. Some corn-blind farmer walled on four sides of his life by superior alfalfa was waiting for her. She began her descent. She passed the eighth floor and the seventh. At 5:15 on the morning of April 18th, 1906, the buildings of San Francisco started to shake. So that's the end of the preface, and that's how I begin this book called Out of Oz. Why the title Out of Oz? For three reasons. One, to my very, very welcome fans, I needed a big public way to signal, this is it, I'm done. It's like out of gin, out of Cheerios, you know, out of plot, out of Oz, out of here, goodbye, I'll sign your books and go home. The other thing is, I love that elderly phrase from the early part of the 20th century. You remember Isaac Dinesen, Out of Africa? That phrase really came from the line, what's the news out of Africa? What's the news out of Sumatra? What's the news out of the State House this morning? What's the news out of Oz? So this is the news out of Oz. But this is the first book that starts someplace other than in Oz, which my other three books have done. So that's the third meaning. It begins and it unites the world in which Dorothy comes from, at least for a little while, with the Oz that we know from MGM and the Oz that I have written about. And finally, I just want to say, when I thought of it, I was really happy, because for a long time I'd thought all those books by L. Frank Baum ended with Of Oz, The Wizard of Oz, Glinda of Oz, The Marvelous Land of Oz. I mean, I was thinking of Sick of Oz, you know. But no, I wasn't sick of it. There was more to know. There was more to find out. But I would soon be out of it, out of Oz. And so I liked using that that phrase of Oz. Well, what does it do to a writer who's had some nice reviews, a slim but enthusiastic readership of my book, Wicked, my first adult novel, though I'd written for children for 16 years before that, and then to find, first, Universal Studios optioned it, and Demi Moore got involved, and you start thinking, Demi Moore. You start thinking, Demi Moore, naked and green on the cover of Vanity Fair. Oh, that's right, we're in church, sorry. and then Demi Moore, it didn't quite work. They couldn't get a script, because Wicked anticipated the return of fantasy, literary fantasy, in that sort of half-light world between adult and children's books, the Harry Potter world, the Philip Pullman world, even the movies of The Lord of the Rings. It anticipated all that by about a year and a half. So the big resurgence of fantasy was just beginning. Wicked was one of the first signs of it, I think, in 1995. Universal Studios couldn't sanction a $100 million budget on a film that didn't have a part for Mel Gibson. So it's basically a story about women. So they kept passing on it, and Stephen Schwartz, the composer, read the book, found out that it was optioned by Hollywood and just about to be under contract, had been there for a couple of years. He went to the producer of the Hollywood film, knocked on the door, closed the door, and said, the scuttlebutt in Hollywood is that you can't get a good script for this movie, and I know why. Why? Said Mark Platt. Stephen said, because everybody knows in America that people in Oz sing. Well, that was true. Even I knew it. In fact, I had Elphaba singing in Wicked long before Broadway got hold of her. I knew she could sing. That was part of her character. She had to be the person with a voice who had never been asked to express herself. That was part of who she was. So when Mark said, well, that sounds great to me, but you're going to have to convince Gregory, and, you know, he's very professorial, and he might, you know, look down on Broadway. You'll have to go talk to him, because he's in charge. So Stephen Schwartz came to see me, and we met in a secret location somewhere in Connecticut. We were both wearing trench coats and snap-brimmed hats. We went walking through the woods, and he said, the reason that I think this should be a play instead of a movie is that your book is very 19th century, and your characters have big, big feelings. They don't hide them back. In a film, they will have to tamp them down. We can't use a voiceover in a film, not since And a River Ran Through It. It's not done anymore. But Elphaba's a big character with a huge soul, and she needs to be able to sing her emotions out. Well, I was pretty convinced about that, but I kept my sort of Presbyterian expression and said, yes, go on. And he got nervous. He said, I'm so convinced you're going to allow me to do this that I will tell you I have already written the first number. It's called No One Mourns the Wicked. And when he said that, he clinched the deal for me, because I knew that if those were the first words people were going to be singing in any play that I wouldn't have full control over, it meant the theme of the play was going to be as important as the characterizations. And that's what I cared about. So deep in my heart, you know, I knew I should look a little grumpy and unconvinced, but, you know, really secretly I was thinking, you know, Broadway! I mean, you know, what's not to love? Come on. So 8 years later, the publication of Wicked, the play opened, and with its $14 million budget, it brought a lot of other readers to my books that had been struggling along. And those readers themselves and their questions to me in their many, many, many letters about what happened next were really the instigation for me to go back to Oz, to get out of Massachusetts, and to go back to Oz. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. My name's Kate. I make comics. I'm gonna tell you all that I'm Catholic, and so to be on this side of the altar and you guys to be on that side is like upside down world. I'm gonna hand out communion after my talk, if no one minds. I'm just kidding, that would be blasphemous. This one I thought I'd start with because, God, I wish I had like a streamlined story to tell you all about, like everybody else here, but instead my comics are all over the place. But this is a good place to start because it's the first comic that really kind of went out there and got a whole bunch of new readers and a whole lot of interest, and it went viral, and people really loved it, and I had no idea that that was going to happen when it started. And it kind of pains me to look at it because it's old and the drawing style I had then was bad. That was the style I had. a little bit less polished than now, but even now it's a little shaky. But anyway, what I do for the most part is take historical events and books and fictionalize them. My work kind of lives a level above the real world, darting in and out and taking things and picking them up and vaporizing other things and turning it into something new. And the main point behind doing that for me is to make it funny. And that's my job. So sometimes, you know, the straight telling, the worst thing about history to a lot of people is that they think it's boring. If you think of it in terms of facts and figures and dates and names, then yeah, it's pretty bad. And I definitely had a few teachers like that. I'm sorry, Dr. Lindell, but yeah. I fell asleep in your class. but you know, I've always taken a lot of humor out of it because history is just so full of like human foible. That's the whole deal all the way through is people. Anything that ever happened that was funny happened in history anyway. So anyway, I'm going to move past Tesla here because Yeah, there we go. There's like a label on this one. Okay, sure. this was the format that I used at first, where I had like an idea and I would draw 6 to 8 panels or something like that, and I would fill it in, and take a joke and build on that idea, but. It became like too large to do a lot of that. Like you have a historical event or a whole novel or a whole piece of history. This is like the South American Revolution. It's supposed to be in a comic, and you can't do that. I would get overwhelmed by how much there was to take in. And before I can actually give it to an audience and tell a joke, you kind of have to take the actual event and give that to them too, and like give them enough exposition so that they know what's happening if they're unfamiliar. Like, who's talking here? when it is, where they are, like around what period, and what's the vibe going on, and then make a joke on top of it. So this like small panel restriction became a bit harder to do. And if you have my book, Hark a Vagrant, which I don't have, everyone else has their book, but I don't. it's yellow. There's a Napoleon on the cover. Then you'll notice that like it's kind of a mix up between things, between these and these, then like longer strips like this that have like a bigger narrative to them. I started to pull the events apart a bit more, and be able to really dig in there and make a good joke if I had a few comics that kind of set the tone first, and then mix them all up so that it was kind of a richer experience for the reader, I hope. I can't put them all up because when you have like a lineup of six comics, it makes it difficult for you guys to see them from back there. But let's try and find some examples. Yeah, see, this is like six comics all together. This was the first comic that I made that I pulled apart. I had an idea for making comics about peasants in the 14th century and how like gross their lives were, but there was still love. And even though it's fiction and even though there's jokes, I do get, you know, mail from people who are like, excuse me, but there's one back here. The first one where they're running and they get really close and they're going to kiss. And he says, I've like never, ever brushed my teeth. I think it would ruin the moment, but no one has. No, I got an mail from somebody who was like, I'm tired of people saying that there's no hygiene in the 14th century, and they actually use this twig and this, like rock mixture or something. They brush their teeth with that. And it's like, okay, but it's still, you know, it's not, I'm writing history books. I'm writing, I'm just making jokes, man. just trying to entertain y'all. There it is. Yeah, okay, I could have zoomed in on that. This was, you could see my slideshow making skills are so good. There's like file names on them. This was the first long form of a book that I took and made jokes about it. And it's kind of like Gregory's approach, but you know, taking from the Oz universe and making something new out of it. I can definitely relate to that because I just like everyone has had to read The Great Gatsby, and when I try to make a book, comic or even a historical one, it's not just about the comic or the book itself. Sorry, where you're like just making fun of it. There's a whole world that exists around the book, people's relationship to it, what they thought about it, and with, like something like The Great Gatsby, everybody had to read it maybe in grade 9. I know I did. I didn't really understand it at the time. Because I couldn't really relate to any of the characters, but they're like, this is the greatest novel of American. I'm Canadian, I don't know why. If you read the greatest Canadian novel, you'd probably kill yourself. They're all really depressing. No, they're great. I hope there's no Canadian authors in here aside from me. There's a lot of like depressing Saskatchewan times, and like the winter was so long. And we were so bored, and then someone died, and God, it was cold. and everyone's like, that's so deep. And American, like, the greatest American novel is, like, a load of young people getting wasted and partying and, like, running over people in cars and stuff. It's great. If someone had told me that's what The Great Gatsby was about before I read it, I'd be all over it. But instead, they were like, here it is. It's just about the American dream and the loss of a generation and something, something. And you're just like, oh, my God, I'm 16. Don't care. So there's more to the book than just the book, I guess, is what I'm saying. It's nice to pull that in and create something new that like kind of takes into account more than just the thing itself. And The Great Gatsby, I don't know that. Maybe it's because everybody had to read it. It caught on pretty well as well. It got in the best American comics and all that. Yeah. Does anyone remember actually, like, the baby? I'm pretty sure there's just, like, one chapter where like, someone brings, like, a baby in a wheelbarrow is it across the room and like, in passing, there was, like, and the baby went by, and it was daisies, and then it never comes back again. I thought that was amazing. they're always in like a drunken stupor, and there's a baby in the house somewhere. Who knows? Not important. And this is another way I like to take books. Yeah, Nancy, she's nuts. take books and turn them into something new, turn them into fiction. Nancy's already a fiction a character in her own thing, but who used to read Nancy Drew books? Yeah, that's right. I never read Hardy Boys, but I had to read I was sick when I was 10. I was put in the hospital for 2 weeks with something wrong with my liver. I don't know. And then after 2 weeks, they were just like, we don't know what it was, but it went away, so you can go home. And I don't know. The only thing that they had to read there was the entire set of Nancy Drew novels, so I read them, and I, like back to back. And I think that I remember them through something like a fever haze, which maybe is where this comes from. By the way, those aren't Ku Klux Klan members. That's like a cult. That's like someone's idea of a cult, is that everyone just wears conical white outfits. And Nancy spies on them. Yeah, I don't know. One of the things about books, especially for kids, is, you know, you pick up the cover and it's supposed to draw you in. You're supposed to think, I wonder what this is really about. Based on the picture in the front, especially with kids' novels, because kids have, like, no attention span, and, well, some of them don't. And you really want to grab them. You want them to pick up the cover and say, wow, what do you think this is about before they get into it? So that's, like, the purpose of it. And then I do that. I take this cover and I sort of extrapolate from what it possibly means. And Nancy just turned into a psychopath. she hasn't a clue. Ha-ha. oh, that was unintentional and so bad. Because she's an empty character. I guess a lot of those kids' characters are kind of empty, too, because you can kind of imagine yourself being that person if they don't have a whole lot of personality. Nancy likes to solve things. She has a boyfriend, and she's, I don't know, she has the money to do it. It could be pretty exciting to be her, but she's also pretty basic. Anyway, what do we got here? Oh, yeah. Every now and then I don't do, you know, something that references from actual history. This is from just something we made up. This is a strong female characters. My comics do often pull from popular culture anyway, so I guess that is pulling from something. We're so used to seeing these ladies in movies and in comics. I don't know how many read comics, but I had to learn about comics when I started because I didn't know anything about them. And then I read, you know, superhero things, and someone would give something to you and say, this, like, you know, you got to read about this one. She's great. She's really strong. She's tough. But all it means is that she, like, beats people up and has sex with everyone and doesn't care. she's so confident. they're terrible people. And they don't have any personality at all. You're like, wow, this is really interesting that this is. Anyway, that's what that was all about. Oh, this is more. This is just drawings. I just made a big load of drawings to show you guys. This is Lita and Zeus, right? I put this up and someone was like, "You never had boobs on your website before." I'm like, "I've had everything else." There's even like a wiener poking through somewhere. If you look close, that's one for the ladies. Anyway, what we got here? Oh, yeah, we just have some things where it worked out really well. I take some comics. Sometimes I don't know anything about them, and I research them for days and days, and it makes me sound like I'm in, like, a basement for days. I just read about them until I try and get an idea of what they're like for the person who knows the most about that thing, because that's who you're making comics for. You're making them for the person who doesn't know anything about it and the person who knows the most about it at the same time, which is why, like, only six panels became a bit stressful, because you want to make people laugh, but you don't want to, like, someone who wrote their thesis on Chopin is going to pick it up and be like, huh. It's just a picture of Chopin, like, farting. and I will put on my graduation hat for that one. I think that this one worked really well. I don't know, getting in there and feeling like I did a good job of getting to know the characters as they were and then making something new out of it. Sometimes it doesn't work as well. I don't know. Let's see. Sometimes you make comics about things that aren't American history and people don't really know what they are. But it's nice that people are interested. That's I guess the fact that I'm not American helps me sort of want to branch out from that. Like, Canadians love my comic, which I'm so happy about, because a lot of times when, like, you're a popular Canadian, people are like, she's so full of herself. And they have problems with people being popular. So I'm glad that, like, fingers crossed, they never, like, turn on me. If I'm on the radio too much or something, they might be like, what a ego. For the most part, people are happy to be represented, and I tried to do that too. So this one was for Australian readers because I have a number of them there, and it's just nice to make people feel included with the thing that they like the most, which is usually a reference to themselves. Oh, that one has a bad word. I don't know if there's babies in here. There could be. Anyway, sometimes in order for a comic to be popular, it just has to be about Lord Byron, and then my work is done. Like, I did this one in my sleep. I could. I just, like, draw Lord Byron's face. If you'll know that any time I update and I have no ideas, it'll just be a big picture of Lord Byron's face, but most people won't notice. They'll write underneath, like, lol. This is the best comic I ever read. Now, it's pretty amazing to see some characters that people really identify with and like, feel drawn to. And I'm like, you make something and it just happens to be about somebody's favorite thing. And then you there's, like, historical superstars, and I've like, stumbled on them by accident, and Lord Byron is definitely one of them. And Sherlock Holmes, why not? let's see. I'm going to find one. Yeah, it's a bunch of junk. Just kidding. And I'm running out of time, so this is the last thing I'm going to say. This comic is, like, I did it really fast. And I like this comic a lot. I think it's funny. But anyway, the main thing about it is that I actually did a lot of research for it, and it turned into something totally different and totally fast. I had, like, Handel was living in London and writing songs for the king, and everybody kind of knew his songs and humming along to it, and Handel's latest jam out on the streets. And at this time, the Beggar's Opera was composed, and it used a lot of Handel's songs because people knew the tune already, and they put in, like, dirty words, and it was about hookers and bad stuff, and it was a huge success. It was an enormous hit, and everybody loved it. And Handel was like, what? Like, this is no good. And I wanted to make something about that. I didn't know how to do it. It was already funny. It was already funny that someone, like, took Handel's work and basically made me get jiggy with it, like, like, ruining his stuff, and he got upset about it. And then I couldn't think of anything, and I like, tried to research for days, like, what people thought, what was happening, and I just did this instead. And it looks like it was made in like, a minute, which it kind of was. But and you wouldn't look at this and think, this is really a comment on the Beggar's Opera, but it was. You never know where it's going to go, but it's a pretty fun thing to go through. Anyway, I think that we're out of time, so I just had wanted to talk about the comics for a bit, and thanks very much.
Hi. We were hoping, I had a PowerPoint that I don't think is going to make it in time, but I am so relieved now because I would never want to follow Kate's amazing, amazing cartoons with, like, a slideshow of my dad. So I think there are guardian angels protecting me. It's just a total honor to be here at the Boston Book Fair on just one of the most amazing panels I've ever, you know, been a part of. Particularly, this feels like far out fiction to see all of you guys in this setting. As someone who has recently interrupted the sleep of the homeless reading to four people in a Barnes & Noble, this is, like, a really amazing crowd. So thank you guys so much for coming. I was going to talk a little bit about, because this is far out fiction, and sort of as a shout out to Gregory, just the Kansas-Oz ratio. So what is it about kind of, like, fantastical, magical, realist stuff that's appealing to write and fun to read? I think Kate said it best when she said it's just really exciting and playful and fun. But I really loved what Gregory was saying about half-light and twilight and sort of what's revealed when you change the ratios of the literal to the fantastic. This book that I recently wrote, Swamplandia, I've been touring to promote it for a couple months now, and honestly, my learning curve is like this. I just can't figure out how to synopsize it in a way that doesn't make people run for the bar. The greatest thing is that it now has, like, an ISBN number, and I can show it to my relatives, because there was a period of years where they'd be like, what's that thing you're working on about? And I'd say, well, It's a family of alligator wrestlers in a mythic swamp, like a mythic version of the Everglades. And I would throw mythic in there so Marjorie Stoneman Douglas wouldn't sue me, you know? Like, just to, I think fiction's a way to avoid litigation also. I was like, so they're in this mythic swamp, and they run an alligator wrestling theme park, Swamplandia. And there's the protagonist, there's this tomboy alligator wrestler. She's 13. Her name is Ava Bigtree. They're these, like, white grifter people who came from Ohio, but they're billing themselves as, like, a lost tribe of Indians. And they have this, like, mom-and-pop alligator wrestling park. And it's, as you might imagine, in this economy, kind of a tough sell. They're up against what I sort of thought of as, like, a dark Disney World, you know, this, like, air-conditioned fascist enterprise called the World of Darkness, where you can, like, buy boiling colas for $8 and... You ride in this thing called the Leviathan that's essentially, you know how those water parks, it always actually feels like you're paying to get digested? You know, you queue up and go down the slide and it really actually feels like uncomfortable, you know, plumbing analogy or something. So that's this park, their rival. And the story begins when the rival franchise has kind of taken over the mainland, which would be, I guess, the Kansas in this story, although it's contemporary South Florida, so it's more like the Oz to Oz ratio. And Swamplandia is this remote island where they're really kind of teetering on the verge of bankruptcy already. And then Hylola Bigtree, she's the headliner. She's their mother. She's beautiful, female alligator wrestler. Passes away. Everyone, all the tourists are very disappointed because she dies of ovarian cancer, not monster attack. I guess the story, so this is still me trying to explain to my family what the novel is about, right? At this point, there's like a glaze over everyone's eyes. They're like mouthing, you know, not too late for law school. they're like making me, I don't know, like match.com profile so I can meet an oil tycoon or something. Everyone's distressed for years. In the wake of the mother's death, one of the sisters, Osceola, not a natural alligator wrestler, on the larger side, very pale, very dreamy, discovers conveniently that she can talk to the dead, or she believes that she can. I should mention there are like no eligible bachelors around, and she's a teenager, so she just begins to date the dead. She uses her Ouija board as a sort of Rolodex to locate boyfriends. And the story sort of, it follows these girls trying to find the spirit of their mother. The older sister elopes with a ghost, and her sister, Ava, tries to find her. I would say that's the more kind of fairy tale, supernatural storyline. Her brother Kiwi, who he thinks he's a genius, they're homeschooled, so he's just sort of giving himself tests and report cards. So he's just kind of grading himself, and it's always A+. And he has sort of a more traditional underworld descent. He goes to the mainland and gets a terrible minimum wage job at the rival theme park and endures testosterone-fueled mockery from other young men. So that's the hell we all recognize, and then I think his sister's on her own quest. So I was going to read just a very little bit from the beginning, and then maybe talk just a few more minutes about kind of, you know, whenever I give this description, it's sort of like the way you lead a dog to a puddle. So then a lot of times, like, the question will be, why, you know, like, why did you do that thing? you know, with, like, you know, genuine curiosity but befuddlement. So I thought I'd talk just a little bit about why tell this story that if you told it in a realist register, I actually think you could transpose it the way you transpose a musical octave, and it would be like suburban New Jersey. One of the girls is promiscuous and nuts, you know, missing her mom, goes kind of crazy, drops acid in the park or something. The younger girl is a tomboy, very confused in the wake of her mother's death, and then there's like a more traditional rebel, you know, Kiwi, the brother in the story, just wants to go to college, has no interest in herpetology, but I imagine in New Jersey he would like ride a motorcycle and I don't know, get his ears pierced or something. So why not just tell that story? And I guess I'll read a little bit and then try to answer that. What's the advantage of telling a story, as Greg said, in half light? So the beginning of the end. Our mother performed in starlight. Whose innovation this was, I never discovered. Probably it was Chief Bigtree's idea, and it was a good one, to blank the follow spot and let a sharp moon cut across the sky, unchaperoned, to kill the microphone, to to let the stage light's tin eyelids scroll and give the tourists in the stands a chance to enjoy the darkness of our island. To encourage the whole stadium to gulp air along with Swamplandia's star performer, the world-famous alligator wrestler, Hi Lola Big Tree. 4 times a week, our mother climbed the ladder above the gator pit in a green two-piece bathing suit and stood on the edge of the diving board, breathing. If it was windy, her long hair flew around her face, but the rest of her stayed motionless. Nights in our swamp were dark and star leopard. Our island was 30-odd miles off the grid of mainland lights. And although your naked eye could easily find the ball of Venus and the sapphire hairs of the Pleiades, our mother's body was just lines, a smudge against the palm trees. Somewhere directly below Hi Lola Big Tree, dozens of alligators pushed their icicle overbites and the awesome diamonds of their heads through over 300,000 gallons of filtered water. The deep end, the black cone where Mom dove, was 27 feet. At its shallowest point, the water tapered to 4 inches of muck that lapped at coppery sand. A small spoil island rose out of the center of the pit, a quarter acre of dredged limestone, and during the day, 30 gators at a time crawled into a living mountain on the rocks to sun themselves. The stadium that housed the gator pit seated 265 tourists. 8-tiered rows ring the watery pen. A seat near the front put you eye level with our monsters. My oldest sister, Osceola, and I watched our mother's show from the stands. When Ossie leaned forward, I leaned with her. At the entrance to the gator pit, our father, the chief, had nailed up a crate board sign. You watchers in the first 4 rows guaranteed to get wet. Just below this, our mother had added in her small, livid lettering, anybody could get hurt. The tourists moved sproingly from buttock to buttock in the stands, slapping at the ubiquitous mosquitoes, unsticking their khaki shorts and their printed department store skirts from their sweating thighs. They shushed and crushed against and cursed at one another. Couples curled their pale legs together like eels, beer spilled, and kids wept. At last, the chief cued up the music. Trumpets tooted from our big, old-fashioned speakers, and the huge, unseeing eye of the follow spot twisted through the palm fronds until it found Hi Lola. Just like that, she ceased to be our mother. Fame settled on her like a film. Hi Lola Big Tree, ladies and gentlemen, my dad shouted into the microphone. Her shoulder blades pinched back like wings before she dove. The lake was planked with great gray and black bodies, and Hi Lola had to hit the water with perfect precision, making incremental adjustments midair to avoid the gators. The chief's follow spot cast a light like a rime of ice onto the murk, and she swam inside this circle across the entire length of the lake. People screamed and pointed whenever an alligator swam into the spotlight with her, a switching tail cutting suddenly into the wavelengths, the spade of a monster's face jawing up at her side. Our mother swam blissfully on, brushing at the spotlight's perimeter as if she were testing the gate of a floating corral. Like black silk, the water bunched and wrinkled. Her arms rode hard. You could hear her breaststrokes ripping at the water, her gasps for air. Now and then, a pair of coal red eyes snagged at the white net of the spotlight as the chief rolled it over the pit. 3 long minutes passed, then 4, and at last she gasped mightily and grasped the ladder rails on the eastern side of the stage. We all exhaled with her. Our stage wasn't much, just a simple cypress board on 6-foot stilts suspended over the gator pit. She climbed out of the lake. Her trembling arms folded over the dimple of her belly button. She spat water, gave a little wave. Oh, the crowd went crazy. When the lights found her a second time, Hi Lola Big Tree, the famous woman from our posters, the swamp centaur, was gone. Our mother was herself again, smiling, brown-skinned, muscular, a little thicker through the waist and hips than she appeared on those early posters, she liked to joke, since she'd had her 3 kids. Mom! Ossie and I would squeal, racing around the wire fence and over the wet cement that ringed the gator pit to get to her before the autograph seekers elbowed us out. You won. So that's the opening, and that was sort of their act, swimming with the Seths, which are, you know, these what they call these alligators. They started calling them that, and then promotional materials are very expensive, so they called all their alligators Seth. And I think what I learned from kind of going around doing readings is that what reads as imaginative on the West Coast, when I went to my home state of Florida, I don't know if there are any Floridians here, no one is impressed, right? Everyone was like, yeah, yeah, the alligators, you know, they're all kind of like jaded Denny's waitresses there. They're like, mm-hmm, you know, it read like reality to them. So, I mean, people would say, the chief, I think that's Jungle Larry, right? You know that guy? I mean, they had physical physical analogs. They'd be like, oh, I've been to that place. You're talking about Wikiwachi Springs, right? I mean, so I think, you know, and I get this question a lot where they're like, well, is what you're writing magical realism? By which I think people mean, is it sort of fantastical things, you know, things that defy the laws of physics and seem really strange, and more realistic things are written in the same register. And I always just think, like, Florida must be a magical realist state then, because what I recall from childhood is going to the Publix grocery store and then going to, like, the Miami Serpentarium, you know, and there was no scene change, right? It was all kind of presented pretty matter-of-factly, where you would walk, like, through the you know, the jaws of a giant fiberglass alligator, and then see a real monster. There's this Marianne Moore line that I love a lot about what a poem is supposed to do, and she says, it's an imaginary garden with a real toad in it. And I really actually think spatially or just geographically that was, I love when people are like, where do your ideas come from? Because I can just give them my home address from childhood, you know, in Miami. It's kind of easy to pinpoint on the GPS. And I really think that what's attractive to me as a reader of sort of more whacked out fiction is that ratio of the imaginary to the real. There's some way in which, in that imaginary garden, you're able to see truths or have insights or things that are occluded just in the chaotic stream of like your regular Tuesday. They're foregrounded all of a sudden. You know, you're out of your regular context. You're in Oz. But the humans in Oz feel absolutely faithful to the way that humans behave in the world. You know, love and grief work the same way, and you're able to sort of see them differently in that carnival light or twilight. And there's also some real pleasure in being the single arbiter of the world that you're making, you know, of this fictional universe. What I end up doing now when I talk about engineering these kind of imaginary worlds is plagiarize Flannery O'Connor, and because she's not with us any longer. I mean, that's also, and she, I think, had sort of some of the most straightforward advice for young writers, which was that fiction, even if it's a fantasy, has to have the eminent possibility of truth about it. You know, her example was The Metamorphosis, right? Which I think has one of the greatest first lines, the greatest sort of Dorothy, we're not in Kansas anymore first lines. You know, Gregor Samsa woke up from troubled dreams to discover that he was inside the body of an enormous beetle, which is like a very ballsy line, right? And I think what I admire about it is that move. It's kind of the fish slap to the face technique, where if you're reading this, you're immediately alerted to the fact that this is not the kind of world that we live in. It's not quote-unquote consensus reality, but it is almost unbearably real to discover your human emotions, human nature in this form. You know, she says that we're alerted to our dual natures in a way that's almost unbearable. You know, we're able to read it in this new context. So that's sort of the answer I would give my uncle on Thanksgiving when he was like, why alligator wrestlers and ghosts? I just think, you know, if you think about the amount of time everyone spends in memory or the imagination or fantasy, it starts to feel pretty blurry to make any kind of claims about what reality is. And I think that the idea of, like, this girl, one of the sisters who's possessed, right? To me, if you've ever been mourning for someone, you know, or if you've ever been really lost, you know, in illness or a delusion or something, it actually feels like spirit possession, you know? I mean, it feels like another descriptive language to talk about something that everybody knows really intimately. And I guess the last thing I wanted to say, since I can't show you pictures of my dad, so this slide 5, it's my dad next to a big buzzard. Let me just grab it really quick. It's just this is a quote from George Sanders, which I thought sort of sums it up for all of us. Ultimately, I realized that there is no real life. There is no objective reality. There's just your version of it, and that version has to be in your language. So it's been a real pleasure to be here. Thank you guys so much.
Thanks, everyone. That was good. Are we... Hello? 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 Is everybody... Can people hear me?
I think so.
Awesome. It seems to have gone on rather suddenly. I just wanted to ask, first of all, so you were raised Catholic, and you were raised Catholic.
Me too.
Were you guys all raised Catholic?
Oh,
me too.
I don't know. Far out.
Far out. I wonder what that says about about things.
Well, you do have to suspend a lot of belief.
Yes.
It's a pretty far out religion.
Yeah, it is.
So... You just spoke to some, Karen, to some of the readerly advantages of inhabiting a Twilight world. And I was just wondering, from everybody else, too, what advantages you have in writing about something that's not quite reality but shares some elements with it.
Are all of our mics on?
I hope so.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
I know I got paranoid that I was breathing really loudly during the presentation. Well, I guess just because we were just talking about that, I think part of it, as I said, you know, you don't have that historical fidelity to worry about. I really do find myself thinking about, you know, like some herpetologist angry letter writing campaign. You know, you don't want to get that wrong. And I think there's a way just for myself that it's a lot easier to be honest in fiction, you mm-hmm. know. That's elastic, that's in Twilight. I think it's easier for me to write something that feels emotionally true. Mm-hmm. The worst stuff I've ever written is when I try to write in some like realist mode and it's just like a couple having dilemmas eating pasta and then it's, you know, it's just feels so dead and flat. But somehow if you like roll a Minotaur in there, you know, or you give somebody green wings, I think that if that feels so disarming, you know, to a writer and a reader that you can be honest in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I also think that perhaps it's helpful to a writer who has pointed out for himself or herself the real main concern of what they want to do, which is seldom the plot or the characters. It's usually another ambition. If you trespass over the border into the half-light, then anybody who follows you as a reader cannot say, you got that mix wrong. As you ended with your was it Flannery O'Connor? George Saunders, of course. That in fact nobody can complain that the ratio of Kansas to Oz is wrong if it's your, you know, if you've done it, you know, you're or whatever else you've done. When I start out to write a book, I always have something that the book is about, and that the half-lightedness of the conditions in which I've chosen exists so that nobody can say, you know, Hitler was not that old when this happened to him, and he was taller than you said, you know, he would have, you know, or whatever. I initially thought I'd write about Hitler as a way to talk about evil. And I thought about that for about 20 minutes, and I thought, I can't do enough research, and all people will be doing will be reading it to see how I'm wrong and how I'm stupid, and they will miss the point of what I'm writing about. So I need to find a place where nobody can criticize my lack of research. My research is my imagination, and my research is my life. And that is might be full of faults, but it's still mine.
I guess I see this slightly differently, because I predominantly write nonfiction. I write fiction, this is something else I do on the side, kind of almost. And the problem in the world of nonfiction is that you're writing about ideas always, and you're trying to write about, I'm often trying to write about culture, but you just can't get people to say what you want them to say. They may be talking about an idea, and you can tell that they have a sense of what they're trying to describe, but they won't put it in the language that makes that clear. And then your job sort of as a reporter then is to sort of construct what that means, but that is a construction. Whereas in fiction, you can just have them talk the way you want people to talk, kind of in this kind of reality-creating scenario that you describe. I actually find it a little much more complicated, though, because the thing is, in nonfiction, coincidences can happen, and they really can't in fiction. The reader sort of demands things to match up in a way in life we do not anticipate. If you're writing about things in real life, sometimes people will just run into each other at the post office. They've had no relationship beforehand, they have this encounter, and that's how it begins. But if you do that in a novel, people are like, that's idiotic. He just had these people, you know. So it's much more complicated to me, and I don't know, I feel like people actually do have a criticism of the reality you create in a way that's impossible to do in actual life.
I think I agree with that. I couldn't help but think as I was, you know, looking over, you know, the edge of the altar here at the title of Far Out Fiction, and remember something that happened about 12, 13 years ago. It was a year that I had a book out. It was the second in my series, and it was it took place in Oz, you know, and at the end of the year, in the New York Times, in the column about what the bestsellers had done for the year, the columnist, I think it was Dwight Garner, said, well, the best-selling piece of literary fiction this year, in terms of its placement on the bestseller list, was Philip Roth's The Plot Against America, and that was on the list for 9 weeks. And I went back to my notes, and I thought, hey, wait a minute. My book was on the list for 14 weeks. But it takes place in Oz, so it's not literary fiction. I wonder what it is. And now I know it's far out fiction. But the interesting thing, I mean, I thought, wait a minute, the Times gave me a full page ad. They had a decent critic, you know, assess it. It was not a total pan, it was not total praise, but it was there. Philip Roth, who is a wonderful writer, I don't in any way mean to make any accusation of competition. But Philip Roth wrote a book about Lindbergh being the president in the 40s and America going fascist. And that is literary fiction, whereas a story that takes place in Oz that has almost no magic in it, but is people struggling under an oppressive government, is not literary fiction. Mm-hmm. Time is one thing and space is something else. I think the New York Times has greatly softened on that in the last, like, just last year. So I'm happy to say that. But it's interesting where people draw the boundaries about what is considered, you know, I mean, Gregor Mensa, the cockroach, you know, the Metamorphoses, that is, that's literary. That's pretty trippy, but that's literary fiction. You know, you don't get that in a fanzine. You get that in your English class. You know, it's just, yeah. You know, something I parse all the time, but.
Yeah, that's
it's hard to figure out.
An interesting division, but certainly, I mean, I know both of you have appeared in. Well, I know you've been in Harper's. Have you been in the New Yorker also? Mm-hmm. Yep, mm-hmm. And your stuff. So, yeah, weird. So I was wondering. I just can't imagine. I don't write fiction, and I was wondering what the biggest impediment to sort of writing about. Something imaginative would be. Is it, I mean, does self-consciousness play a part? I mean, it just seems like it's such a difficult line between writing something entertainingly wacky, for lack of a better word, and cheesiness. And how do you avoid that?
Because
you all have done it. Avoid being cheesy and avoid thinking of yourself as such when you're writing these, you know, sometimes whimsical, fanciful things.
I don't know about anybody else, but mine is just, you know, the end goal is to like write a decent joke. So it could be totally silly and totally cheesy, and I have the liberty of like changing a subject every page when you go through the book, like it's all over the place. So yeah, sometimes I fall into that, but sometimes that's fun. If I had to construct a whole book on one thing, that would be a totally different subject. Like when you guys are talking about writing fiction and just like. It's different for me every time I start a new page. Sometimes I take facts and turn them into drawings of butts.
I like to embrace my inner cheese. I think that is a great challenge to say, if I know in my own heart how deeply serious this is to me, then it's kind of fun to push it. Mm-hmm. Also, and to say, okay, so I've got Dorothy back in Oz, and, you know, she's going to go on trial for killing the Wicked Witch of the West because the political climate has changed, and Glinda's under house arrest, and the Cowardly Lion's on the run from the law, and how far can I go? You know, almost playing with the tropes of cheesiness, mm-hmm. as it were, mm-hmm. and giving people a good read while at the same time saying, underneath it, it really is no fun to be under house arrest, even if you're Glinda. I mean, there's some real fallout to what it is that happens to individuals.
Well, that's very true, because the idea of cheesiness is not content-based. It's motive-based, and it's perception-based. Because when you think of the things that we recognize as cheesy, we immediately say, it's like in the movie Xanadu, or like the music of Whitesnake, or like Laverne and Shirley or something. We would all say that, but what are people really saying when they call that cheesy? What they're really saying is that someone is consciously being unserious in order to lock into something kind of cheap. You're trying to immediately get someone to appreciate something for sort of a non-intellectual reason. I mean, if P.T. Anderson makes Xanadu, that's irony, that's commentary. If Pavement records Still the Night, that's not a cheesy song then. Yeah. That's a commentary on that kind of music. So the thing is in a way you can't really control it, though. Because you can't control how people are going to perceive it. All you can really do is kind of think to yourself, well, I'm not doing this for a cheap sort of, you know, a reason that's only commercial or only to get immediate attention. The reason I'm doing it is because I think this is a cool idea, regardless of how that will be perceived. And then you hope that translates to the person reading.
Yeah. You never know. Maybe Whitesnake was like, people will weep when they hear this.
Well, no, that's the thing. It's like it's not David Coverdale's fault. Yeah. I mean, he didn't like go like, this is gonna really fucking fool people, man. It was like that wasn't his thinking when he went into it. But that's how it's looked at.
Yeah.
That's how, you know. So that's why I don't think it doesn't really matter what the content is, whether it's in Oz or in a swamp or switching around these historical facts. Mm-hmm. It has to do with what people perceive your motive to be.
Right, I totally agree, and I was thinking about alchemizing facts into butts, which is the most amazing alchemy you can do, and I think to have a sense of humor about it, right? Like, that's it, right? Like, you can't have a bunch of wolf girls in wolf suits singing Oh Danny Boy, but, like, very seriously. You know, I think that there's a way that if you're self-aware about, but who knows? I don't know. Sometimes I just think the other way to go is just acknowledge that your starting idea is like a really bad Saturday Night Live parody and just commit.
I just think if you're lucky, in 10 or 20 years, people will look back and not give you that effect that, like, this is like a Xanadu.
Well, yeah, it's like time does it. Time is the thing. You know?
Yeah, but you look at people like, you know, Günter Grass and you know, there's so many great writers of the mid-20th century and beyond, I mean, up to the end of the century, who kept pushing and pushing and pushing, and because their intention was dramatically serious to them, they could get away with a hell of a lot, and make the reading experience lively and full of nubble, full of texture, comic texture, as well as you know, vaunted, you know, big idea direction. Hmm.
I'm also, it's interesting that you should bring up Günter Grass, because I was wondering if you guys all had some sort of miserablest favorite author that's very, very non-fanciful, and everybody's books are very funny. And
Ooh, that's a good question.
I was wondering who your sad, favorite sad writers are. Sad and serious.
I really love Alice Munro, but I think she kind of gets this false rap. Yeah, she's really funny, and she's really far out there. Mm. You know, I think she gets this fake. I think it's like what you're saying, like Nova Scotia, lots of lakes, you know, sorrow. But there's some really wacky things that happen.
So cold.
So
cold, like
fiction
my
froze.
Soul. major themes. Yeah, I guess. God, when I was a teenager, I tried to read a bunch of those great novels, and I was like, I'm going to be the smartest teenager in the world, and tried to read Ulysses and didn't make any sense of it, and read a lot of those, like, kind of dry novels, and for sure, anything that takes itself too seriously. I did have, like, had to read part of Pamela in a literary class once, and then I found out that Shyamala existed, and I was like, Shyamala. The best book of all time.
Right.
Yeah. there's so many examples of that dry stuff, but it's great. Especially Victorian literature, which is like, if it's melodramatic, it's just like, this is for your weeping pleasure.
Yeah. They're not shy about cheese, right? They're like, here's some more queso. Like,
yeah,
it's like, oh, Victorian England.
The Dying Orphan. Chapter, like, 1 to 20. It was a long death.
I don't know if there's any good writing that would be dry. I don't know if I would, you know, if I mean, I don't, I would be hard to say it's like, this is a good book, even though it's super dry. There's books that are very grim that I like.
Grim.
David
yes.
Gates is a contemporary person who writes incredibly dark books about people's lives falling apart and from the perspective of the person watching his life sort of disintegrate. I mean, it is interesting in general because when one thing, if you anyone out here is trying to become a writer and you'll deal with people in the publishing industry, one thing that they will often tell you is that you can't write a funny novel that ends darkly because the reader will feel betrayed. You can't have a book that's really funny all the way through and then at the end it's awful. And yet, as a writer, those are always your favorite kinds of books. The kind of person who wants to write is drawn to that kind of story that's very entertaining and sort of kind of electrifying and then has this really dark turn that sort of then validates the idea that, like, the world is bad, you know? Because it's like you're trying to share this experience that you view the world nihilistically, you think life is bad, and that, aha, so is this guy too, and he's a genius, and so it's really, almost all the right books I like are like that. I mean,
Do you like it in that they're comic and they turn...
Yeah, I mean, if I was listing the kind of books I like, that would be almost all of them.
Right. Well, the first book that came to mind when you described that kind of book that is comic all the way through and then turns sad and you said you can't do that, I thought, oh, but Christopher Moore's Lamb is a brilliant example of that. It was so funny all the way through. It's about the life of Christ and you know how that ends. And you're laughing and laughing and then you
don't
get
spoilers.
Yeah. and then you get to the end and it's been almost, you know, it's almost a Saturday Night Live skit, and then death starts to happen, and it doesn't negate the comedy of life. It makes it more comic and more wonderful. I mean, I think that's a brilliant.
Well, I mean,
in
all these cases, it's always the exception to the pre-existing idea that ends up being great.
Yeah.
So it's always trying to just sort of slide in through these little gaps in the forest.
Well, I've just been, we're done. We don't have any more time. I'd like to thank everybody for coming and thank our lovely panelists. I'd just like to remind everybody that the book signing will be taking place right outside in the Boston Book Festival tent. So if you head out the doors, everybody will be here. Thank you.